Okay, go ahead, grab a seat, and if you don't mind, turn to Hebrews chapter 9. We are this morning returning to our study series in the New Testament book of Hebrews. This is a series that we actually started months and months ago, and then we made it all the way through chapter 8. And then we took a summer break. We did the little Who Is This Man series. And now we're coming back to finish it up, and it'll take us all the way to Christmas. And we're calling this particular section of Hebrews Champs and Misfits, which is kind of a strange title, but it will make more sense later on. When we finally get to chapter 11, the writer is going to take us back to the Old Testament, and he's going to introduce to us all these great heroes of faith or champions of faith, folks who believed God and persevered in astonishing ways. And then at the same time, because of their faith, they were often considered misfits, so to speak, by the world around them. And this theme that we're coming back to will make more sense when we remember who this letter was written to. And I know we did a lot of introductory material when we started this series. So I want to give you just a quick review so you know where we're at. But the first readers of Hebrews were actually Jewish Christians. That were living in or near Rome. They had a Jewish background, but they now had become followers of Christ, and they were Christians. But at this particular point in time, the cruel despot Nero was in the early stages of his rampage against Christians, and as a result, these Jewish Christians were considered outcasts in their culture. They were rejected by the Jews because of their profession of faith in Jesus, and they are also outcasts in Roman culture because they were followers of Jesus. And they were actually persecuted to the point where some of them were starting to think about walking away from their faith in Jesus. They were thinking about going back to Judaism and their old way of life. And so would you. If you couldn't find work, if you couldn't buy food, if you didn't know you might leave your home and never come back, or you might return home and find out that your wife and children had been arrested, you'd begin to wonder whether or not the sacrifice of following Jesus was really worth it. And so the writer of Hebrews, he's saying, I understand the pressure, I understand the temptation, but you don't want to walk away from Jesus. You don't want to go back to Judaism, and here's why. With the arrival of Jesus, with the arrival of Messiah, we have the fulfillment of everything that God had promised to his people. And now we have a new covenant. We have a new arrangement with God that is just so much better in every way. But to get us thinking this morning about the particular topic that we're going to tackle in chapter 9. I want to read a page out of a book by a guy by the name of Richard Selzer, he's a physician, one of my favorite writers. He wrote a book called Mortal Lessons, Notes on the Art of Surgery, of all things. And in a chapter called The Knife, he writes this. He says, one holds the knife as one holds the bow of a cello or a tulip by the stem. Not palmed, nor gripped, nor grasped, but lightly with the tips of the fingers. The knife is not for pressing. It is for drawing across the field of skin. Like a slender fish, it waits at the ready, then go. It darts, followed by a fine wake of red, the flesh parts falling away to yellow globules of fat. Getting a little queasy? Me too. It gets worse. Even now, after so many times, I still marvel at its power, cold, gleaming, silent. More, I'm still struck with a kind of dread that it is I in whose hand the blade travels, that my hand is its vehicle. That yet again, this terrible steel-bellied thing and I have conspired for a most unnatural purpose. the laying open of the body by a human being. Now with that, I want to show you a verse from Hebrews. This is Hebrews 4, verse 12, where the writer says these familiar words, writes these familiar words. For the word of God is living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing to the division of soul and of spirit, of joints and of marrow, and the discerning the thoughts and intentions of the heart. In other words, the Bible teaches that there is an inner place in every human being that no scalpel can reach. No matter how skilled the surgeon, no matter how sharp the knife, externally, we are all made up of a body. You can fact check me on this. Everybody has a body. Just take a look at the person next to you. Check that out. We're flesh and blood and bone and muscle and tissue that is both tangible and visible. But then within our body is an intangible, invisible network of feelings and desires and impulses and urges. Woven into the very fabric of my being is a heart and a will and a soul and a spirit. And I'm not sure anyone has ever been able to untangle entirely the threads in the fabric that are woven together. And one of those threads is the conscience. Now, what's the conscience? Well, one little boy said, it's that part of me that feels bad when everything else feels good. Someone said, conscience is that still small voice that makes us smaller still. John Stott, in his book, Authentic Christianity, writes at length on this topic. He says, the conscience of fallen human beings is often mistaken. It needs to be educated by the Word of God. And it is often sleepy. It needs to be awakened by the Spirit of God. True also, some people deny that they have any sense of sin, insisting at the same time that everything is relative now, for there are no moral absolutes anymore. He says, do not believe them. And C.S. Lewis, of course, said, you know, if someone tells you that, there are no moral absolutes, he said, just take their wallet, you know, and see what they do. He says, for by creation, God still endows all human beings with a moral sense, which our inherited fallenness has distorted, but not destroyed. You know, the old Jiminy Cricket theology of, you know, let your conscience be your guide. You can't really do that. Conscience isn't, you know, infallible. He says, unless and until people so violate and smother their conscience as to cauterize it, a word that Paul uses in 1 Timothy 4:2, or renders it insensitive, it continues to trouble them. They know they are sinful and guilty, however much they may protest to the contrary. I always love the story about the guy who wrote to the IRS, and he says, I haven't been able to sleep because last year when I filled out my income tax form, I haven't been able to sleep because I deliberately misrepresented my income. And he says, I'm enclosing a check for $150, and if I still can't sleep, I'll send you the rest. Well, here's the thing. Although our conscience is flawed and it's faulty and fallen, we still have one. And we've all violated it. Here's a question. How many of you believe that it's wrong to lie? Show of hands on this. Some of you are hesitating. That is not the correct answer. Okay, how many of you have fudged the truth when your dentist asks you how often you floss? Same number of hands. How many of you have done something worse? Right? We all know this, right? We've all said something, done something, or not done something, right, that we feel guilty about. Dostoevsky, the Russian writer, says, every man... Let's not leave out the women. Every man has reminiscences of which he would not tell to everyone, but only to his friends. He has other matters in his mind which he would not reveal even to his friends, but only to himself, and that in secret. But there are other things which a man is afraid to tell even him to himself. And every decent man and woman has a number of such things stored away in his mind. And so do you. And so do I. With care, a surgeon's scalpel can slice through skin with precision and take out a malignant tumor, but no knife, no matter how sharp, can reach inside and clean out the cancer of a guilty conscience. That takes the work of God. Look at verses 13 and 14 of chapter 9. The writer says, "For if the blood of goats and bulls and the sprinkling of defiled persons with the ashes of a heifer sanctify for the purification of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God," here it is, "purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God." Now, the writer has already explained that Jesus, because of his perfect sacrifice, has become the high priest of a new covenant, of a new arrangement that we have with God, and that God had promised in ages past that made the whole old arrangement, the old covenant, obsolete. And one of the things that we learned, this is all the way back, into last spring, one of the things that we learned in chapter 8 is that the central feature of the new covenant is the emphasis on the internal as opposed to the external. The new arrangement deals more with the inner person, and the writer picks up on this thread in chapter 9. And to those who are thinking about returning to the rituals and to the externals of their former religion, the writer says, that's not a good idea. And here's why. And he starts with what these Jewish Christians already know. Okay, we're going all the way back to verse 1. And he says, now even the first covenant, that old arrangement, the old Mosaic covenant, had regulations for worship and an earthly place of holiness. And that's absolutely true. And these old, Jewish Christians who had cut their teeth on the Old Testament scriptures, they know that. When the Israelites were in the wilderness, God had given Moses very specific instructions regarding worship. He spelled out precisely what the place of worship was to look like, exactly how it was all to be arranged. And when he says the earthly place of holiness, he means the Old Testament tabernacle. Now, some of you know this, but some of you may not. The tabernacle, what he's referring to, was a portable place of worship. It was this like large tent-like structure that they would carry around with them as they were wandering around in the wilderness. And then when they would come to a place of rest, they would set it up, and that would become their place of worship. And then the writer goes on to give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of the design, verses 2 through 5. And it's a little complicated, but I'll help you out with it when we get through. He says, "For a tent was prepared, the first section in which were the lampstand and the table and the bread of the presence. It is called the holy place. And behind the second curtain was a second section called the most holy place, having the golden altar of incense and the ark of the covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden urn holding the manna and Aaron's staff that budded in the tablets of the covenant. And above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat." And he says, of these things we cannot now speak in detail. In other words, he says, we're not going to get bogged down in the minutia. There's a lot of details here, but we're that we could describe here, but it's not necessary. He says, I just want to jog your memory for a minute to the basic layout of the tabernacle. Now, to help you with this, I'm going to give you a couple of pictures. So this will help you. That's kind of a picture from the outside. Through the miracle of modern technology, that's exactly what it looked like. Okay, but now let me give you the layout. Let's show you the next slide. There you got there. So the outer part of the tabernacle, I guess can't really... Can you go back to the other one for just a second, Kate? The outside, it kind of looked like a big tent without a top. But it had these walls around it. Okay, now go back to the other one. So you You see that outer call, those outer walls, which are about 75 feet by 150 feet. From that back door to this wall, and then probably back to the back corner, that's about 75 feet and, 150 feet. So, I mean, it's not too different from the size of the space that we're in this morning. I wish we could say that we designed it like that, but we didn't. It just turned out that way. So there was this courtyard, and you can see that, in which there was an altar, and there's this big brass bowl full of water for cleansing, and the altar is where the sacrifices were made by the priests. And then there was that tent, and that's the little space there, I guess, on my right. It was called the Holy Place. And that was kind of the first veiled area. Then there was a second veiled area called the Most Holy Place. You got that? See, Most Holy Place. Also known as the Holy of Holies. Kind of goes by different language in different places. And for the Jews, this was the most sacred place on earth. It contained the Ark of the Covenant before Indiana Jones found it. On the other side was a cherub. On each side was a cherub, and together these two cherubim had golden wings folded over the altar, looking at the mercy seat where God forgave the sins of the people. Now look at verses 6 and 7. He says, "These preparations having thus been made, the priests go regularly into the first section, performing their ritual duties. But into the second, only the high priest goes, and he but once a year," underline that, "and not without taking blood," underline that, "which he offers for himself and the unintentional sins of the people." The writer says that once, they settled in a place and they set up the tabernacle, the priests went about the daily activities of their divine calling. And it was a day in, day out kind of deal, continuously offering sacrifices. But he also says that once a year, the high priest would go behind the second veil and offer a special sacrifice. And he would take a bowl of blood and into the presence of God, and he offered it as a sacrifice for his sins and the sins of the people. And one of the messages of that was, without the shedding of blood, there is no entrance into the presence of God. And then the writer goes on to explain what this means. Look at verse 8. "And by this, the Holy Spirit indicates that the way into the holy places is not yet opened as long as the first section is still standing, which is symbolic for the present age. And according to this arrangement, gifts and sacrifices are offered that cannot perfect the conscience of the worshiper, but deal only with food and drink and various washings and regulations for the body imposed until the time of reformation." What's he saying? Well, he's reminding his readers of the inadequacies of the old arrangement, and specifically of the rituals of the tabernacle. And he's emphasizing two failings of the old arrangement, the old system. First, under the old arrangement, the worshiper had limited access to God. A priest would be lucky enough if he was chosen to go into that outer, that first veiled area, and that would only be for a week. And then ultimately, it was only the high priest that actually went into the presence of God, into the most holy place, into the Holy of Holies, and that was only for a few tense moments, kind of in a cloud of incense and a bowl of blood, and it was just once a year. And the lay person was left out in the courtyard. I don't have it up there, but it was over on that side. That's as far as they could go. That was as close as the average Joe would ever get to the presence of God. Ann Ortland, in her book, Up With Worship, She says, in many of the beautiful Gothic churches of England, there exists a small slot looking something like a mail drop to the side of the massive doors. It is called a leper's squint. Because as the magnificent worship service was going on inside, the lepers would huddle around and take turns peering through the slot to observe all that was taking place. It would mean that as the service progressed, each leper would be able to come and look for maybe 20 or 30 seconds before his or her turn was up. So I'm saying, can you imagine? You have these magnificent churches. Some of you have seen them in Europe or whatever. And here's this little slot, and that's all they could, you know, they could look through. That's all they could see. But the writer of Hebrews is telling us, that the lay people in that time, they didn't even have a leper's squint. They had nothing at all. And he tells us that the tabernacle was actually designed that way on purpose. It was designed to be symbolic in its architecture. It was designed to show that the way into the immediate presence of God was not yet open, and then to make them anticipate the arrival of the Messiah who would introduce a whole new arrangement for access to God. But as deficient as the old system was in providing access to God, that was only part of the problem. He also points out that the rituals of the old arrangement, as significant and as magnificent and as valuable as they were insufficient. All of the sacrifices, the offerings, all the activities of the priests did not and could not make the worshiper perfect in conscience. In other words, the rituals were superficial. By themselves, they did not deal with the inner issues of the heart and the soul and the spirit. One commentator put it like this. It would be a little bit like a person who gets dirty, but instead of taking a shower, goes and buys a new outfit. On the surface, they appear clean, but underneath, they're still dirty. Or taking a shower with your raincoat on. You feel the effect, but you don't get the benefit. And the reality is that's the way it is with rituals. They are symbolic and external, and they do not cleanse the person within. To put it a little differently, religious activity will not solve the problem of a guilty conscience. And in fact, all the religious activity in the world not by itself will not clean up your life. And for some people, the fact is, religious activity, kind of like drugs or alcohol, becomes kind of a cheap anesthetic to deaden the pain of a guilty life. Well, in verse 11, the writer begins to pull everything together. He says, But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, he's saying, this is not what you want to walk away from. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, underline this, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, he entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by means of his own blood, and thus securing an eternal redemption. When Jesus appeared, he opened up a whole new way of approaching God. He didn't slip through the veil of an earthly tent for 5 minutes with a bowl of blood as an offering and then exit until next year. Instead, when Jesus appeared, he tore down the veil. He opened the way into the true tabernacle, of which the earthly tabernacle was only a symbol or a shadow of the heavenly reality. Remember in Matthew chapter 27, at the very moment that Jesus died, do you remember what we're told? That the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom as a symbol of the new access, of course, that we have with God. And notice that Jesus entered into a tent, it says, not made with hands. In other words, this is not a temple that you can diagram on a piece of paper, you know, or show up on a wall. This is a different kind of tabernacle. It's not a tangible tabernacle. It's a tabernacle that exists in a spiritual dimension of reality that we can't even begin to imagine, but it is nonetheless real. And Jesus, by his death, opened up a way into it. And as the writer has said at least half a dozen times in the book of Hebrews, so that we might draw near to God. When Christ appeared, it was out with the symbols, and it was in with the reality. When Christ appeared, it was out with the externals and in with the internals. Because of the cross, we have unlimited access to God. We can come to him in the eternal tabernacle at any time. Makes no difference what day of the year or what time of the day, anytime, anywhere, we have access to God. We have the privilege of coming into the presence of God. That's one of the big benefits of this new covenant, this new arrangement now that we enjoy with God. And it's this reality, if nothing else, should dramatically transform our worship. Because it means God is here. He's not back there. Some of you wonder, what is back there? This bunch of equipment, guitars and stuff, electronic equipment. He's here. He's here. We are in his midst. We're in his presence in a direct way that is different than in the days of the tabernacle. God is no longer distant and hidden behind some mysterious veil. He's here. He's resident in the temple of the Holy Spirit, which is his people. We're not spectators in worship. We're participants, and God is the audience. A.W. Tozer said, I think it is the deep-seated notion that God is absent that makes so many of our church services so insufferably dull. Someone else, I don't know who said this, even a church service can get pretty exciting when God shows up. But there's more. And this really gets to the heart of the matter. Back to verses 13 and 14. This is where he kind of pulls it all together. He says, but for if the blood of goats and bulls and the sprinkling of defiled persons with ashes of a heifer sanctify for the purification of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God? In typical rabbinic fashion, the Jewish Christian writer of Hebrew makes his point by arguing from the lesser to the greater. It was kind of a typical way of making an argument with rabbis. And he's saying, if the sacrifice of animals could accomplish the cleansing of the flesh, how much more can the perfect sacrifice of Christ accomplish? If the blood of animals was sufficient to make the body pure, how much more can the perfect sacrifice of Jesus make our souls pure? And he tells us the sacrifice of Christ goes under the skin, below the surface, down to the deepest spiritual dimensions of my heart and cleanses my very conscience. His blood cleanses me down to the deepest, dirtiest, most secret recesses of my heart, down to the most remote nooks and crannies of my conscience. Gordon MacDonald, in his book, Rebuilding Your Broken World, makes an absolutely staggering statement. He says, beneath the surface of our skin, there is an inner space that may be just as expansive in a spiritual dimension as the universe is in a physical dimension. As expansive as the universe is outward, so inside that expanse is also infinite. Well, how do you clean up something like that? Well, you can't. It takes the work of God. Chuck Colson, in his book, Who Speaks for God, tells a story. It's about a guy by the name of Albert Speer, which is not a name that probably many of us recognize, but he explains who he is. He says, Albert Speer was once interviewed about his last book on ABC's Good Morning America. Speer was the Hitler confidant whose technological genius was credited with keeping Nazi factories humming throughout World War II. In another era, he might have been one of the world's industrial giants. He was the only one of 24 war criminals tried in Nuremberg who admitted his guilt. Speer spent 20 years in Spandau prison. The interviewer referred to a passage in one of Speer's earlier writings. You have said the guilt can never be forgiven or shouldn't be. Do you still feel that way? The look of pathos on Speer's face was wrenching as he responded. I served a sentence of 20 years, and I could say, I'm a free man. My conscience has been cleared by serving the whole time as punishment. But I can't do that. I still carry the burden of what happened to millions of people during Hitler's lifetime, and I can't get rid of it. This new book is a part of my atoning, of clearing my conscience. And the interviewer pressed the point, you really don't think you'll be able to clear it totally? Speer shook his head. I don't think it will be possible. For 35 years, Speer had accepted complete responsibility for his crime. His writings were filled with contrition and warnings to others to avoid his moral sin. He desperately sought expiation, all to no avail. How do you clean up something like that? You can't. It takes the work of God. And as someone has said, the only detergent that God recognizes to cleanse us from sin is the blood of his Son. And the writer is saying to his friends, well, you know, why would you want to go back to something else? Why would you want to go back to something less? Why would you want to go back to the rituals and the sacrifices that weren't sufficient in the first place, that were only symbols pointing to the promised reality in Jesus? And if you go back, you might save your skin from religious persecution, but what are you going to do about the condition of your soul? The French have a saying, there is no pillow so soft as a clear conscience. But here's the deal. The one who bought and paid for the pillow is Jesus. And he offers it to you. Now, as we come to the Lord's table this morning, I want to read another story by Richard Seltzer. And he writes about an unforgettable moment. He had to do surgery on a lovely young woman, and she had a tumor that needed to be removed. And in the course of the surgery, he was forced to cut a little tiny facial nerve. And it left her mouth twisted and distorted. And her lovely face would now have this disfigurement for the rest of her life. This is what he writes. He says, I stand by the bed where a young woman lies, her face post-operative, her mouth twisted in palsy, clownish. A tiny twig of the facial nerve, the one to the muscles of her mouth, has been severed. She will be thus from now on. The surgeon had followed with religious fervor the curve of her flesh. I promise you that. Nevertheless, to remove the tumor in her cheek, I had to cut the little nerve. Her young husband is in the room. He stands on the opposite side of the bed, and together they seem to dwell in the evening lamplight, isolated from me, private. Who are they, I ask myself, he and this wry mouth I have made, who gaze at and touch each other so generously, greedily. The young woman speaks. Will my mouth always be like this, she asks. Yes, I say, it will. It is because the nerve was cut. She nods and is silent, but the young man smiles. I like it, he says. I think it's kind of cute. And he says, all at once, I know who he is. I understand. And I lower my gaze. One is not bold in an encounter with a god. Unmindful, he bends to kiss her crooked mouth, and I so close, I can see how he twists his own lips to accommodate to hers, to show her that the kiss still works. And I remember that the gods appeared in ancient Greece as mortals, and I hold my breath and let the wonder in. And that's what Jesus did, didn't he? In Jesus, God appeared and he accommodated himself to us. He stooped down, he took on human flesh, and then he died on a cross to show us that the kiss still works. So that we would know. So that we would know, no matter what, no matter how twisted or deformed or damaged or scarred we are, that we are still unconditionally and utterly loved. And the proof is on the cross. You think about that.